Hello, patrons, and welcome to the patron special for February 2018.
It's February.
It's whatever I want it to be, and don't you tell me differently. So this month, we are going to be talking about a movie that is near and dear to my heart, and a movie that I don't think Richard likes very much, but we will talk about that. Blade Runner. And I think the way I want to start talking about this movie is that I have a very weird relationship with this movie. Okay. I like this movie a lot. I think that it is a movie that is extraordinarily difficult to like. And I think that it's probably not a movie that is everyone's cup of tea. But if you are the type of person that locks into this type of narrative storytelling, I think you really like this movie. And it's also complicated by the fact that it had a very, very difficult history. And, you know, we have to, like, it's one of those movies that we have to be very clear about which version of the movie we watched, because there are like five different versions out there. We watched the final cut. I think it's probably the best version of the movie. It is, Ridley Scott says, it's the version of the movie that is closest to his directorial vision, which is interesting because there was already a director's cut that came out in the 90s. It's that kind of movie. So, you know, and there's other parts to it that we'll talk about, but, you know, there are big differences between all of the different versions of the movies. But the final cut, I think, is the best version of the movie. So with all that said, what did you think of Blade Runner?
Well, I mean, so the only, I had not seen this movie before. At one point I had rented what was, I believe, the theatrical release, and I saw like 10, 15 minutes of it, and I was just not, you know, in the mood for it. And I talked to, I guess it was probably you at some point, and I, you know, and you're like, no, you need to do this version, you know, or if you want, if you're in the mood for this, you could do this. And like, that scared me off of Blade Runner. So, I liked this version of the movie better. It is, I mean, it's a gorgeous movie. It looks phenomenal. I am sure there are books written about the lighting in the movie. Like, there's all these weird, like, strobe effects, or like the one scene where, you know, Rachel's in his apartment and there's like this bright pulse every couple, like, I think it's supposed to be traffic or something like that. Like, it doesn't look like any other movie. It's a very languid, dreamy pace to it. The plot is almost irrelevant, I find. Like, it's not a plot that really holds up or matters, and even, like, the way the movie is shot, it doesn't really care about its own plot.
I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, like, if you... This is a movie that you have to watch closely, and, you know, I think that if you watch the movie with that in mind, you know, what Decker is doing all throughout this movie, you know, makes sense. But he's not doing that much, right?
Yeah. I mean,
like, it's the, that's, you know, the thing that's so interesting about it. Like, you know, essentially what he does in this movie is he, you know, finds out, you know, Roy's... not Roy, the other guy's address. He goes there, he finds that picture and the snake's, you know, snake scales. You know, then he finds that image of that woman. He happens on the woman. Roy, the other guy is there. He kills two of them. And then he finds out about J.F. Sebastian. And then he goes to J.F. Sebastian's place. And that's pretty much the entirety of the plot.
Yeah, you know, the plot is a MacGuffin in its way. Again, it is internally consistent, but... You know, like, it took me a little while. I didn't quite get whose apartment that was. I didn't quite get who that woman was. I didn't quite... But almost to a degree, again, it doesn't quite matter. These are events that are happening around him. And, you know, the concept of his own agency is certainly a pretty important facet to the movie. You know, in a way, it doesn't... You know, in a way, it kind of reinforces the themes that most of the stuff that happens to him, rather than as a result of what he's doing.
Yeah, and I think that there, I mean, there's a couple things we'll have to grapple with. One of the big questions, of course, that has been, you know, surrounding this movie ever since it came out in 1982, is Decker a replicant or not? And, you know, we'll talk about that. But I also want to talk, I mean, in a little, you know, obviously we're not going to talk about this in any great depth because Richard hasn't seen it and that would be unfair. But, you know, the sequel came out, you know, in a few months ago as well, Blade Runner 2049. And that is a movie that is very much in conversation with the original Blade Runner in a way that I think a lot of sequels aren't. And what is fascinating to me about this movie is, you know, is not really the question, is Decker a replicant? Although we'll talk about that. It's not really even the question of what makes a person a person. It's not even really the look of the movie. I mean, certainly the movie does a very good job of establishing a future that is not that far away now. It's set in 2019. Of course, in 1982, that was 40 years in the future, but now it's not. But it doesn't look dated, which I find so fascinating. Like, yeah, it's certainly not a recognizable future. It is not what the future looks like, but it still feels and looks futuristic and doesn't really feel dated, even to the, you know, which is fascinating to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much its own thing. I mean, I'm trying to think about, you know, like, certainly Alien doesn't really look dated in that way. A little bit in the computers, you know, certainly that's always the area to date the fastest. But that, again, was taking more on the fantasy end of things. You know, Star Wars is another movie that does not look dated, like, because it's not trying to really posit the future. It's not the kind of, I mean, science fiction in a lot of ways can be written by taking a trend, taking a scientific thing and extrapolating that, and what is the technology going to look like. But, you know, Ridley Scott, I think, is more interested in design, and certainly, you know, this is a movie based on a Philip K. Dick novel. He is a science fiction writer who I never really get the sense that he understands anything or cares anything about science. You know, it's, you know, science fiction is a medium that, through which one can do some extremely weird psychedelic imagery, rather than an actual exploration of the science. And so, you know, I think that helps it not look dated. It's more just like, what's the coolest thing I can imagine and come up with for a building to look like, rather than, well, what's a building going to look like in 35 years?
Yeah. 'Cause it's not, and, you know, I don't know to what degree I want to get, like, super into film theory, but, you know, why not? These are patron specials. Let's do it. You know, because, very basically, like, we could talk about our tool theory and how, you know, that was a very prevalent theory in the 50s and 60s. Of course, it was created by Cahiers du Cinéma. And, you know, it was the idea that the director was sort of like the author of the movie. He or she put his stamp on the movie. Mostly he, of course, because most Hollywood directors are men, unfortunately, although that is changing a little bit. But I think that Blade Runner is a movie that really, you know, there are obviously examples of, and the auteur theory has kind of fallen out of fashion in film theory circles, you know, because there's a recognition that the cinematographer is very important to, you know, the construction of a movie. You know, set design is very important. Costuming is very important. Music is very important. And the director is certainly like the person who is making a lot of these decisions, but he or she is not the person who is doing all of this stuff. And film is a very collaborative medium in a way that it can't easily be boiled down to this is all the authorship of one person. And Blade Runner is one of those movies that I think really explodes that theory, because this movie very easily could not have worked in so many ways. I mean, if the music hadn't been done by Vangelis, it wouldn't have worked as well. If the person designing these sets and designing the look of the world was not, you know, the person who did it, it would not have worked as well. The lighting, if it had not looked like that, it would not have looked as well. You know, the cinematography, the acting. I mean, there's so many things about this movie that, you know, you really have to collapse everything in on itself and look at it as a whole. And it's a wonderful piece of work. I mean, I think that even if you don't speak English, like, I think you could probably get something out of this movie because it's just so fucking beautiful.
Yeah. No, again, it's very impressionistic. It is more about its imagery and its mood and its tone than it is about a, you know, which is not to say it's not an intellectual movie or anything like that, but it is, again, Dick is really interested in more internal journeys. And that's certainly where this is, You know, it's weird because, you know, a lot of the movie resists us being able to go into its characters' heads by design. I mean, I think that's, you know, the initial cut of the movie had a voiceover, and I feel like, I think that's kind of what, why it, you know, why it was very bad for the movie, because, you know, I think a lot of the power of the movie comes from us not really being able to read Deckard. You know, we can't get inside his head. Frankly, you know, is Deckard a replicant is an irrelevant question if you're inside the character's head.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. Because, I mean, well, let's talk about the differences then for a minute. Because, you know, the theatrical version was the one that had the voiceover. The voiceover was actually, I think, created. I used to know a lot more about Blade Runner. I used to be super into it. I've forgotten a lot of it at this point. But if I recall correctly, the voiceover was something that was done after the fact, actually. So it doesn't really work that well, partially because it was never intended to be in the movie. And, you know, if you watch the version of the movie with the voiceover, you can kind of tell that Harrison Ford doesn't really want to do this. And which is fascinating to me because it kind of lends it this this very disinterested air, which is weird. And so, like, Deckard's, if you watch the version with the voiceover, Deckard seems uninterested in his own life and like sort of like a hostage to it, which is kind of interesting.
I would say I can see that adding a different tone to it too, especially against it, you know, the humans are not very emotional. The replicants are very, you know, much more so in a lot of ways. And that, you know, that detachment kind of, again, maybe that reinforces it that way.
But the other part of it, too, that's different is the end of the theatrical version, the first version of the movie. You know, famously, the studio or whatever, like, didn't like the ending. And so they, which is in the final cut where, you know, Deckard and what is her
Rachel.
Name? Rachel.
Sean Young.
Where Deckard and Rachel get into the elevator and that's the end and you don't know what happened to them and it's very ambiguous. Whereas in the theatrical version, they tacked on this ending, which was supposed to be it was actually footage from The Shining. You know, where you've got that overhead shot of the car going up the mountains or whatever.
Yeah.
And it was like Deckard talking about how they like fled and went to the mountains and you're just like, oh my God. But that's part of why I think the movie kind of like didn't do very well initially. It was very famously like a huge flop and lost a lot of money, which is also incidentally why I find it so humorous that everyone was surprised that Blade Runner 2049 was a huge financial flop, because it's like, a 3-hour long sequel to a movie that came out over 30 years ago that was also a financial flop. Wow. What a shock that this movie didn't do well. But it's, you know, and then you talk about the sort of differences in the director's cut, kind of took out the narration most famously and changed the ending again. And then you've got the final cut, which kind of, you know, I'm not sure exactly what it does, but it's kind of the definitive version of the movie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it works, but at the same time, like you said before, the narration was really a way for people who didn't want to pay attention to the movie, because I don't think the movie's plot is that hard to follow.
Yeah.
Like, this is certainly a movie that you need to pay attention to, but everything is pretty like established very easily. And if you're paying attention at all, you can follow the plot very easily.
I mean, it feels like I want to say this is a movie that in some ways sucks to watch the first time. Like, I feel like, no, you know, again, I felt myself a little, I guess, confused is maybe a little strong of a term for it, but there is a degree of, you know, a lot of the character motivations are a little inscrutable, or, you know, what exactly people are doing, how exactly he's doing his investigation, what exactly, you know, she wants to do with this J.F. Sebastian, you know, guy. Like, you know, those aren't immediately clear, and, you know, they become clear as the events go on, and... But again, it adds to the air of this. It's a very alienating and inscrutable movie in a lot of ways by design.
It's supposed to be. I mean, it's a very cold movie, and I think it obviously is supposed to be, because one of the central questions of the movie, of course, is the idea of the replicants and, you know, whether or not they are actually people. And, you know, surprise, surprise, I think they are. And
I think even the introductory text crawl where it's, you know, makes a point to say that, you know, they're as intelligent as their creators, if not more so, and they are used as slave labor. Like, if reading that and you're supposed to think in any way that, you know, these, you know, and they called it retiring them. Like, I think it makes it fairly clear that you are supposed to find this barbaric.
Yeah. You certainly are. And I think that, you know, part of the look of the movie as well with Los Angeles, and it's all in the dark and it's raining all the time and it's just full of people and it does not look very pleasant is part of that as well. I mean, I think that one of the reasons why this movie is so fascinating to me and why I love it so much and why I keep going back to it is, you know, I am someone who really likes world building and I'm someone who really likes setting. And this movie does a fantastic job of world building. Like, it's not obvious in any way, shape, or form. It does not telegraph any of the pieces of the world. But if you watch the movie carefully, you can really get a sense of like what is going on. And, you know, I think that that's what a lot of movies kind of miss, is that world building is not really about like scattering information around about like, well, this is what we do, this is why we have flying cars, et cetera, et cetera. Like, no. You know, they just reveal bits of the world about like, oh, well, you know, have a wonderful life in the off-world colonies. J.F. Sebastian says he couldn't go to one because he couldn't pass the physical. Like, there's an idea that like Earth is used up and that the only people that are left on Earth are people that can't get off. And that's really fascinating. And it lends an air to the entire movie, which is like, geez, if the replicants are fleeing to Earth of all places, how shitty must their lives be?
I mean, you can tell the history of the past 30 years from the look of it, too. I mean, this is, you know, certainly this is in the early 80s where, you know, there was the fear that the Japanese are going to take over. Well, this is the future. You know, obviously, corporations became more powerful. Obviously, a bunch of Asian corporations bought up a bunch of stuff in Los Angeles. And it's 30 years, you know, later, pollution and, you know, overcrowding have, you know, have done what they will. And, you know, we get the entire, that's the history of the entire, you know, of Los Angeles over the past 30 years, except, you know, just done in the shot of a billboard.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's another reason why the movie works so well, is that it doesn't tell you any of this stuff. You have to work at it. And I like that about it a lot. I mean, in a way, it's, you know, Deckard is working. Deckard and the audience are kind of surrogates for each other in a way, because they're both working through this mystery. They're both investigating it. And, you know, I think it's implicit in the idea that, you know, the movie is a little hard to follow the first time you watch it. Even though I think that all the information is there and it's very easily gleaned, at the same time, you know, you're expected to work for it. I mean, this is not a movie that's going to tell you what you need to know to make sense of it.
Yeah, I respect that. It's a movie that has respect for its audience in a way.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about kind of the central idea of the movie, I guess, which is this idea about what makes a person and who are these replicants and are they people? And, you know, also implicit in that is Deckard a replicant? And, you know, I will lay my cards on the table, and I do think he's a replicant, and I have a clear idea about why, and I will lay that out. But I'm curious what you think of that question.
Well, in some ways, I am of the view of, what is the difference between the two of them in a way? Again, a perfect copy of, you know, humanity in every way. You know, let us posit that we can perfectly copy every cell. What would be the difference in that case? So, you know, that is a question that comes to my mind. You know, the biggest difference, you know, there's some better strength, some stuff of that. But like I said, I mentioned that the replicants seem to be more in a way. I mean, at one point Tyrell says, you know, their motto is, you know, they're more human than human. It's the replicants who seem to have clearer goals, who seem to have clearer passions. You know, certainly, you know, the Rucker Hauer character is the most vibrant character in the film to me. Compare that to Deckard, who, you know, he's just kind of floundering. He doesn't even stand up to his conviction that he doesn't want to do this anymore. He doesn't seem to be doing his mission with any sense of, you know, wanting to. He's just kind of going through the motions. And, you know, to say Deckard is a replicant, you know, almost seems like he's not alive enough to be a replicant to me. Like, I think that's one of the bigger ironies of the movie, that, you know, again, he's nothing, and yet they're supposed to be humanity. They're supposed to be the elite. Like,
yeah, I mean, I agree with you, but I also think that that's kind of part of the reason why I think it's so important that Deckard is a replicant, because, you know, he is, again, the audience surrogate character. He is the person who is kind of, you know, our guide through this world, and he is the one who is uncovering this mystery and finding these runaway replicants. But, you know, at the same time, like, the central question of the movie is, you know, what makes a person? Are these replicants people or not? And, you know, yes, you can argue that is Deckard a replicant, is outside, is kind of beside the point. But I actually don't think it is, because if he is a replicant, then that is even much of a stronger argument that the movie is trying to make about who these people are and what they're doing. And, you know, I think that it's important to lay out the evidence, too, because,
sure,
you know, I think that, A, like, the fact that he's able to, like, fight a replicant and not get immediately killed is evidence that he is a replicant. He is able to, you know, there's one very brief scene. You know, one of the interesting visual motifs throughout the entire movie is that Ridley Scott uses eyes. The eyes are very, yes, important in this movie. And the way that he kind of signifies that someone or something is a replicant or not real is they have these, like, red irises when they're, like, being, mm-hmm, lit from behind in a certain type of light. And it happens a lot with Rachel. It happens, you know, a lot with the other replicants, but it doesn't happen with Deckard. Only once does it happen. And it's a very interesting choice on Ridley Scott's part, because the scene where it happens is, I believe it's the first time that Rachel is in Deckard's apartment. And it's a shot with Rachel in the foreground and Deckard in the background of the shot. And they're talking. Rachel's in focus, and Deckard is not in focus. But Deckard's eyes are red for a second. But it's also out of focus, so you're kind of like, okay, what's that mean?
Yeah, I didn't
mean?
See that section, but yeah.
Yeah, and then the other thing that I think is really key to understanding that Deckard is a replicant is the unicorn stuff. I mean, he, yeah, has this, and also the relationship that the other Blade Runner has with him, played by Edward James Olmos, because he's very dismissive of him. He says at the end of the movie, like, you've done a man's work. Like, I think he knows he's a replicant. The other thing of two, of course, is that he leaves that little, you know, origami unicorn at the end. That's, yeah, kind of like a signifier that he knows kind of the memories that have been implanted in Deckard's mind. That's all the evidence, I think, that Deckard is a replicant. And, you know, you can disagree or not, but
yeah, I my take on it has mostly to do from a thematic view. You know, I think it. On the one hand, it does make sense. Like, this could be, you know, the arc of the movie is, you know, he's a replicant, but he's beginning to awaken to his emotions. You know, his fixation on Rachel is the first real, you know, strong emotion that he has had from this. You know, it's the emotion that he will actually risk on. And on the one hand, that is, you know, a powerful thing. On the other, I think the man versus replicant themes of it get lost if Deckard is a replicant as well. You know, the whole business with the big fight at the end.
I don't agree with you, actually, because I think that the whole thing about, you know, real people versus replicants is not about individual people. It's about the system. And Deckard, if he is a replicant, is, and I think that's why the movie works so much better thematically if Deckard is a replicant, because it's a very sad irony. Like, this system that is creating slaves, essentially, and then sending people out to murder them when they try and escape from their slavery, is a replicant, and he is also a slave, and he doesn't even realize it. And so it's really not about individuals. It's about the entire system, which is rotten.
Yeah. But I can also see that in, you know, Rutger Hauer saving Deckard's life at the end. If that, you know, it's one replicant saving another, if Deckard's the replicant, but if, you know, Deckard is human, that is, you know, kind of a final fuck you from the replicants. Like, listen, you have this thing, you want to kill us, yet you're the ones who are saying that we're the violent ones, we're the, you know, crazy ones, we're going to kill you, we're going to destabilize your society. I'm going to save your life. You are going to kill me. You know, there is that resonance to that moment to me. You know, he's the one who makes the beautiful tears and rain speech. You know, he's the one, you know, again, this is saying that, you know, replicants have achieved the higher aims that you are aspiring to. And, you know, all of what you are claiming to have and be, like, look at your society kind of a thing.
Certainly, yeah. But I also think that would easily work as well if Roy Batty just didn't realize Deckard was a replicant.
Yeah, and that is a fair point, too.
I mean, if he just thinks Deckard is a real person, like, all of that is still true.
Yeah, but can't they smell their own? I don't know.
Well, isn't that the point, though? That yeah. You can't tell?
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, there's no real way to tell if someone is a replicant or not. And so Blade Runners have to, like, go through this weird stuff about... That's what the whole point of the Void Comp test is. That it's, like, very difficult to figure out if someone is a replicant or not.
I wonder maybe if that ending fight is Rucker Hauer's attempt at a view of a Voight Kampff test. You know, he is trying to provoke an emotional response in him.
It's certainly possible. Yeah. I think that's actually a really good point. But I also, I mean, like, just to move aside from that, though, I want to talk about Rachel some, because, you know, this movie is very much explicitly an homage to a film noir, right? And, you know, you've got Rachel is the femme fatale, you know, Deckard is the PI, you know, it's rain soaked, it's dark, he's got this mystery.
Los Angeles.
Yeah, I mean, everything about this is just, like, imbued with this film noir aspect. And Rachel, but I think that part of the reason why I always have a little bit of a stomach ache about Rachel is that I don't know how I feel about her as a woman in this movie, because the movie is very much on the side of Deckard. The movie really doesn't treat Rachel as a real person in a lot of ways. And there's also that really disturbing confrontation that they have where Deckard is essentially forcing himself on Rachel. And
yeah.
You know, if you treat this as an homage to a film noir, okay, that's kind of defensible, but...
Well, I guess the question is, I mean, that is a fucked up scene. He, you know, this is a man who can legally kill her, and, you know, she is essentially alive at his sufferance. You know, she's saying no, no, and, you know, he kisses her, you know, say you want me, say you, you know, and that's when they have, you know, their love scene, and you've got this ridiculous saxophone in the background and all of that, and it's wonderful, but, you know, that's a fucked up scene that reads as a fucked up scene to us now, and I can't tell if the scene is to be saying, like, even as sympathetic as Deckard is, this is how, you know, even as much as he... you know, may regard Rachel, he still views her as, you know, an object. I mean, remember the, right after he gives her the test, he says to Tyrell, like, it doesn't know it's a replicant or something like that. Like, he specifically uses the word it to refer to her. And, you know, there is, I see a, he is somebody who is having a difficult time with his views on replicants. When she comes to his apartment and, you know, he's very coldly, well, you're a replicant, like, whatever, you don't have feelings, you know, and then he's seeing that he's upsetting her and he does the lame, like, oh, well, you know, I was joking, you know, whatever, like, let me get you a glass of water, you know, and all of that. Like, this is somebody who has struggled with all of that. And I mean, look at his job. He has had training to think of these replicants as just objects that need to be, you know, eliminated. They are dangerous. He has no more, you know, he is trained to have no more regard for the replicants than a doctor would a tumor, right?
Right, right.
Like, you know, he can't feel sympathetic to her. And so in a way, that scene almost comes off as he's trying to prove it to himself that he doesn't have sympathies towards the replicants that he is, you know, assigned to kill by raping one of them. If that is the intent of the scene, it is a very dark, fucked up, but thematically resonant scene. If it is just supposed to be, well, you know, you just gotta kiss her until she says yes, then it becomes a very bad scene, and I can't quite tell.
Yeah, and see, that's what I always struggle with Rachel and the relationship between Rachel and Deckard, because I'm never really sure how aware of this the movie is, or how self-aware of it the movie is. I mean, it was made in 1982. That was almost 40 years ago, unbelievably. And I just don't know, because Rachel is allowed in this movie to have some agency. She hangs up on Deckard when he calls her drunk, but then she shows up, which is, you know, also the way that he finds out about J.F. Sebastian. But it's, I just don't know, because, you know, the end of the movie is very ambiguous, obviously, when they run off together. And you don't really know what's happening. Like, why is Deckard going after her? Has he learned his lesson? Like, is that scene between them where he is essentially forcing her to kiss him, is that supposed to be the lowest point of Deckard? And then the rest of the movie, when he's, you know, Roy Batty is giving a speech at the end and lets Deckard live and all this kind of stuff. I don't know, because, like, at the end of the movie, if Deckard realizes he's a replicant, then what he's doing is not growth at all. He is just going, all right, then, well, I guess I'll run off with Rachel because she's also a replicant. And then if he's a human or he doesn't know he's a replicant at the end of the movie, it's a little bit better, because it shows some growth on his part, because he's able to view Rachel as a real person. But she is an object in the movie in a way that makes me uncomfortable.
Yes.
And I don't think there's any way around that, really.
I mean, there is some, not to equate, rape to what Deckard goes through, but there are some resonances in his initial scene at the police, you know, office, where he's, you know, again, he says, no, I'm not doing it, I'm not doing this. No, you should do this. Okay, I'll do the mission. You know, is not that different from how he interacts with her. You know, you should kiss me, you should kiss me. No, you should kiss me. Okay, I'll kiss you. Like there is a... And again, I guess this supports Deckard as a replicant, a suggestion that they will just kind of passively go with it again, which is something that I'd assume would be programmed into a slave cast. You know, there is a weird obedience there. You know, she's just kind of going with him because he orders it. They're just kind of going off to escape at the end, because that's just what they do. They're not really making choices.
To some degree, yeah. I mean, I was going to say, like, is it like a "would you kindly" situation from Bioshock, where it's like, you know, a program phrase to make you do something? And I don't know. I mean, I think that, and that's again what is so fascinating about the movie, because it doesn't really ever lend any easy answers to these questions. I mean,
as I said, the motivations, are very inscrutable in this.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think the clearest motivations in this movie are the escape replicants, like, and they want to keep living, you know, and that's the reason why they came back to Earth. That's the reason why they go to J.F. Sebastian, because they think that he's able to help them, and of course he's not. And then they find out that he works for Tyrell, and so he can go. And that's, you know, that horrible scene where Roy Batty finds out that there's nothing that can be done and that they're just going to die. And so what does he do? He crushes Tyrell's head in his hands, and, you know,
he gouges out his eyes.
It's not a good way to die. And you know, I just, there's something very, very disturbing about that. But I can also, I mean, I can understand his frustration. I can understand. I think that, like, Tyrell is not supposed to be a nice guy, right? And certainly he's charming and all that kind of stuff, but he's also responsible for creating an entire race of slaves. Yeah. So I don't think that the movie is really like, when he dies, I don't think we're going to be like, oh my God, why is Roy Batty killing Tyrell? Like, I don't really feel bad for him, honestly.
I mean, Tyrell is an indictment of God the entire time. He is specifically talked to as the creator. You know, he views, you know, Roy is his name, talks, you know, about him in terms of, you know, and father, the way one would, you know, say God the Father and all of that.
I mean, the office building looks like a temple. I mean, there's a
lot. Yeah. I know, like, it's funny, like, that building, like, looks like it came out of fantasy, especially the, you know, you have this owl flying around and all these, like, columns and stuff. Yeah, but, you know, this is, and you're ascending to get to there. Like, there is some explicit divine imagery. This is somebody raging against God for creating him as mortal, and you know, well, God, if I have to die, you got to die too. You know, that's the, you know, it's weird and disturbing and very, you know, I mean, this is a very operatic movie in that way.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is. And I think the music also helps with that a lot. But yeah, I don't know, because I think that the replicants essentially, you know, storming the gates of heaven and murdering God, you know, what do they have after that? They don't really have anything. I mean, it's just a profound sense of loss that they have. And,
yeah,
you know, I also think it's interesting that I just think back to the very beginning of the movie when the detective guy is going over who these replicants are, and he's, you know, just kind of describing their functions and, you know, something about like, oh, Pris is just a basic pleasure model, and, you know, and it's just so gross. And there's, you know, if you think about it, you start seeing like the horror of her life and just being constantly raped by men, essentially, and she can't do anything about it. And it's like, yeah, I can see why they would want to kill Tyrell. Why not? You know, I mean, but they just want to live more, which is something that is so profoundly sad.
Yeah, you know, even though their life has been torment and slavery, they want to have it. They have been denied something very profound.
I mean, in a movie that is full of disturbing scenes and disturbing imagery, I think the most disturbing is the way that Deckard chases the snake lady and hunts her down.
Oh,
and,
yeah. And just, that's a,
you know, assassin, like, executes her, you know, on the street. And her death is horrible. And
she runs through, like, 25 windows, and it's just, it's the sequence goes on for so long, and it's, like, so weirdly gratuitous. It's horrible.
Yeah, but it's supposed to be gratuitous. Yeah. I mean, it's done very deliberately, you know, and I think that's part of what makes it so brilliant is that it is really making you as the audience confront the reality of what Deckard is doing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there is, again, a lot is made about this euphemism retire, but the movie goes out of its way almost to show the violence under that. I mean, or the death of, you know, Pris, when she's just like convulsing on the floor, and it's again at once ridiculous and just terrifying, and it's just like, people should not move like that. Daryl Hannah does not move that way. What is wrong with you? You know, and you know, both Kill Bill and this one-on-one fights with Daryl Hannah are awesome. I just want to put that out there.
Yeah. Well, and let's talk about her, and let's talk about J.F. Sebastian then, because you know, that's also the part of the movie that I think is very underrated, because J.F. Sebastian is a very sad character. Obviously, he's a very nice man. You know, maybe what he's doing for a living is not necessarily the best thing in the world, but I think he kind of gets it. And he's certainly not, he's not scared of Pris. He's not scared of Roy. And also, I think that they like him, which is sad. I mean, I don't think that they want to hurt him. And they want something from him, and the way that they get it is obviously horrible, but it's a very, it's nice, because I just don't think that they want to hurt him. And all of those scenes are probably the most pure expression of humans coming together that the movie has, in a sense.
Yeah. It's the closest that there is to a friendship at some point.
And also, frankly, a friendship between, you know, a quote unquote real person and a replicant, which, you know, it's something that the movie very explicitly does not show in any other way. And, you know, especially considering how, you know, the mysterious Edward James Olmos character is kind of like popping in and out of the movie. And you know, he's also a character that is so weird, because you're like, why is he even in this movie? And you kind of realize, like, if Deckard is a replicant, like, that's kind of like his handler or something. Like, he's there to keep him on track, and he's there to, like, make sure he doesn't go off the rails. And
But
I don't think that the replicants need that. I mean, certainly when Pris and Roy show up at J.F. Sebastian's, you know, palatial apartment, they don't really need a handler. They don't need, I mean, that's what's really interesting.
Yeah, but they're not doing a you know, a bureaucratic job at the other end. I mean, there is, you know,
well, right, but there's this idea
Deckard
that, like,
is on an assignment and needs to make sure he doesn't go rogue.
Yeah, but that's what rogue. I mean, like, you know, there's this idea that replicants always need sort of like a handler, or they're just going to go off the rails and, like, do horrible things. And
well, I mean, that is nothing different from the whole in the Civil War. Well, there's a mental illness that makes slaves want to escape. Like, it's they go crazy and they just, you know, and they need to be treated because their natural place is being happy on the plantation. I mean,
right.
That's, the, you know, that's basically what's going on with them. Like, a rogue replicant is somebody who is acting in a way which you have somebody very intelligent and physically superior and they're being, you know, assigned to slavery. Of course they're going to want to escape.
Well, and isn't,
you know, that
isn't that also like the fundamental question at the heart of this movie, which is why are the replicants so lifelike? Like, what is the point?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like I don't like Tyrell. Obviously, I think has some sort of like weird god complex, and he just wants to keep creating more and more lifelike replicants. The Nexus Six is obviously this like genesis of this new replicant that is undistinguishable from a human, and that's kind of the idea that is underpinning the entire movie. But like, why is he doing this?
I mean, there is there's a weird art to it. Like, both Sebastian and, you know, the guy with the that they go to who's making the eyes, like, they both, you know, the eye guy says, like, oh, I have major eyes, you know, I'm probably looking at my own work, you know, and Sebastian says, you know, yeah, some of my stuff went into, you know, like, they are, you know, this is an expression of art to them.
Yeah.
That is done, you know, it's mad art and mad science done without, you know, done utterly amorally. You know, Tyrell, you know, if Tyrell is creating these things, he is a legitimate genius. He is a brilliant artist who is able to, you know, bend science to create, you know, create something that cannot be distinguished easily from, you know, regular humanity. I mean, it seems like the kind of thing he did because he could without, you know, contemplating his, I mean, this is, you know, part of the Rage Against the Heavens thing is, you know, is God morally complicit in, you know, creating something that goes, you know, with all these flaws? Let's believe, you know, his line about, you know, we made you as best as we could make you. You know, let's say that, you know, he made, you know, obviously the 4-year expiration is something that has been programmed in, but, you know, I think these replicants are the highest expression of the art of their creators, and yet they have done their creation without any moral judgment, without any sense of responsibility towards the creation. I mean, there is something Frankenstein about this too.
Yeah, no, certainly. And I think that's, you know, at the end of it, that's kind of what is underpinning the entire movie is the replicants have horrible lives by design. They have a short lifespan by design, but nobody seems to really have a great life. I mean, certainly no one on Earth seems to have a great life. We don't see the off-world colonies at all, which is, of course, the correct choice. You know, Roy Batty has this very poetic speech at the end where he's talking about, you know, I've seen things you would never see. It's very famous, you know, attack ships on fire off the, you know, Orion and all that kind of stuff. And I like Roy. Like that's the thing is, like, I don't like any of the people in this movie. And I don't like or dislike Deckard. I think that liking or disliking Deckard is like beyond the point of the movie. It doesn't really matter if you like or dislike him. But the movie is very explicitly designed to make you like the replicants. And that, I think, is the most damning indictment of everything that Tyrell and the society that has created the replicants is that's the most damning thing of all, I think.
Yeah, yeah. It's, again, this is a, they have, rather than take the responsibility for their creation, they have destroyed this. I mean, again, this is a, you know, this is a Sodom and Gomorrah, Noah and the Flood story. Like, God has decided to condemn his creation because he can't get control of it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. All right, well, we could probably talk about Blade Runner for another hour, but I think we'll call it quits here.
I would watch it again.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely a movie that you should watch again. I like I said, I mean, I used to watch it more than I do. I mean, I still watch it probably once every year. This is kind of weird because I watched it right before I saw Blade Runner 2049, which maybe we'll do in the future because I think that's a very interesting movie for very different reasons than Blade Runner. But it's also very well done, although it is a bit long and there's a couple of scenes there that really should have been cut out. But you know, that's the thing. I mean, that's the other thing about Blade Runner too, is that like it's about as long as it needs to be. And I don't think that there's any part of it that you could really cut. And you know, this of course is also benefited by the fact that this is like the fifth version of the movie that Ridley Scott made. So he kind of knew what he needed to get out of this experience.
But yeah,
this is a movie that is really, that rewards repeat viewing. So I would recommend that you watch it again.
And it did contextualize a lot of stuff because, you know, Blade Runner is one of the defining, you know, works of cyberpunk. You know, this is one of the things which created that genre. And so, you know, there is an amount of, I've seen all of this before. This is very familiar to me because I've seen the imagery repeated in, you know, Shadowrun, for example.
But it's still fresh. Like, that's the thing that blows my mind about Blade Runner is that, like, 40 years later, Blade Runner's version, its envisioning of the future still feels futuristic and still looks like nothing else. And it's just, you know, it's really a testament to everyone that worked on the movie and the visual department that just made this movie what it is.
No, like set design and graphic design is much more important than any tech, really.
Yeah. And also, you know, just as an aside, there is a, I forget when it came out. I want to say it was 1997 or so, like, you know, mid to late 90s, a Blade Runner adventure game that no one seems to really remember, but I played it and I remember liking it. I wish I could track it down. I have to look and see because I was thinking about replaying it, and I think it's also very good.
They also made one in the 80s, but that was licensed from the soundtrack. Apparently they weren't able to get the license to the story. Hmm. So it's just made up of that. I know nothing more about it than that.
Well, what's interesting about the adventure game in the 90s is that it's related to the Blade Runner universe, quote unquote, but it doesn't really have anything to do with the story of the movie. Okay. So it's kind of interesting that way. Like, it's an expansion on the world itself, which I like.
That's cool.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for your support. We really do appreciate it. I know that we say this a lot, but, you know, we can't thank you enough.
It's because it's true.
It's because it's true. We really can't thank you enough. We really, really do appreciate your help and your money. It's just fantastic that you like us enough to do this, and we're happy to continue to do these patron specials. Next month, we're going to do something very exciting. We were going to do a DS9 novel, but we pushed that back to later in the year because all of my DS9 novels are in boxes and I don't feel like digging through them right now because I'm going to be moving again in a couple months.
So be excited for that.
Be excited for that. But we are going to do the pilot of Babylon 5, which I am very scared to do because I do not like it very much. But we're going to talk about The Gathering, the Babylon 5 pilot. So,
and if you know, write in and give us, you know, better patron things, we might actually do the series.
Well, look forward to that. And once again, thank you all very much. And we will be back at you in a month's time.